Welcome to Detoxicity, by men, about men, for everyone. This is a podcast that's attempting to remix the narrative around masculinity, and I thank you for listening and supporting. If you're new to the podcast, I hope you check out the archive, which contains over 150 episodes. I'm always happy when someone reaches out with a friendly word or constructive criticism, so never hesitate to hit me up either via IG at DetoxPodGuy or via email, detoxpod@gmail.com. You can also contact me if you're interested in being a guest on the show or if you know someone who might be a good guest for the show. There's also a Detoxicity Patreon. Patrons get episodes 1 week early, plus I will mail you a cool DetoxPod fridge magnet. Go to bit.ly/DetoxPodPlus to find out more. Oh, one more thing. Late last year, I completed my certification courses and I am now a life and relationship coach. I'm taking clients. Go to mike-joseph.com and book a free consultation. Thanks for listening. I really do appreciate you. So just about every episode of Detoxicity is independent from the previous one. The podcast itself is grouped by a theme, clearly, but each of the episodes can be listened to with no context of what the previous episodes have included. And this is the same, but when I think back to recording this episode and the subject matter of this episode, I'm inclined to compare it, I guess, in a way, to the Ned Donovan episode from a few weeks back, where Ned spoke very honestly and very poignantly about his struggle, his family's struggle, his partner's struggle with infertility and the constant back and forth and ineptitude of the medical system. And I don't know if it's that this topic is similar or if I recorded it at the same time or what it was. But anyway, my interviewee for this episode is Tony Pacitti. I met Tony via the internet, and I'm not exactly sure how we connected. But his story is really interesting for a couple of reasons. One being that he is a relatively new father, and he became a father in the spring of 2020, which, for those of you with short memories, was not a very, very good time for anything to happen that involved doctors, because it was right at the start of the COVID pandemic in the U.S. So that's something in and of itself. The second part of that is that Tony's wife, the mother of these two children, underwent a series of psychotic episodes after giving birth to these children, and because of that, there were a bunch of circumstances that Tony found himself in that he was not expecting as a result of becoming a dad. So this episode covers the 2020 of it all, how he and his wife have addressed what happened and how they've in ways recovered from what happened. In addition to just the process of being a father to two boys in 2024. So there's a lot going on in this episode. I am really proud of this interview. Tony is a fantastic speaker and is able to articulate what has happened to him and is happening to him with such clarity and honesty. So I really hope you listen and I really hope you enjoy this episode. Everybody, this is Tony Pacitti.
My name is Tony Pacitti. I'm a writer living outside of Providence in Rhode Island with my wife and our twin sons. And after having our kids shortly after the pandemic started, we had some pretty difficult postpartum complications that sort of been the focus of my writing as of late. You know, I think having come through the other side of it, found myself in a position to want to sort of advocate for something that I don't think people are talking enough about, especially from the perspective of dads or just partners who are not experiencing these types of complications. So,
right. And there's a lot to unpack just with the couple of short sentences that you said, talking about that particular situation that you went through. Certainly, I don't know that there are too many podcasts with guys talking to guys about dealing with postpartum depression in a partner. And I, you know, I'm childless. Mm-hmm. And I want to know all about the journey, so I'm not even really sure where to begin.
Sure.
But, well, let's start from the beginning, I guess. Have you always wanted to be a dad?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I'm not somebody who would have just gone with, you know, the quote unquote, the plan, if that's not something I wanted to.
Sure.
So yeah, you're sort of raised, you know, with the idea of, you know, you grow up, get married, have a family, get a job, blah, blah, blah. But I always wanted that. I always liked kids. The idea of being a dad was always exciting to me. And my wife felt the same way. Like, as long as she's, you know, ever been aware of wanting anything, she's known she wanted to be a mom. So it was never a question for us until it was. You know, we spent 5 years trying to have kids and, you know, infertile for no reason other than it took too long to happen. You know, like once you try for a year, they're like, yeah, you're infertile. You're dealing with infertility. No one's telling you it's not going to happen, but they weren't saying it's not happening because of X, Y, Z. They're just like, you're both healthy. It just hasn't happened yet. So it took a while. And then we had our kids via IVF. And then they were born April 2020.
That is an interesting time for children to be brought into this world because, the pandemic kind of kicked in full force, I guess, really like the middle of March. So you were just like pandemic-sizing yourself. Right? This thing was so new and scary to most people who didn't really know what was going on. In the midst of all that, did the fact that there was this global pandemic happening freak you out even more?
Yeah, it really did. So yeah, we had, you know, her baby shower. We had it like this cool, like hipster donut shop here in Providence, 30 some odd people all in the room, hugging, fucking thrilled. A lot of family and friends who like, and we were very open about our struggles to get pregnant. So really all of us kind of celebrating and we weren't even thinking about it. And then days later, our governor is like, shut it all down. Like, this is here now, you know? So I missed a few weeks of appointments, but I had been there for everything. I wanted to be there. I wanted to see them on screen for the first time. I wanted to be part of those conversations where we got tests back and we knew what we were getting into and that everything was okay. So yeah, it was really strange. And then like, you know, people were hoarding toilet paper. Mm-hmm. We could find diapers, but we couldn't find wipes because people were like, well, we assume there are disinfecting properties in baby wipes. There's not. So we couldn't find them anywhere. Yeah, and it was tough. And then on top of that, 2 days before the boys were born, me and most of my department at my job were told that we were going to be put on furlough. So like, plus side is I got to keep my insurance. The flip side is, after that furlough period, was there going to be a job to go back to? And we had twins. So we were about to have twice as many mouths to feed. And the pandemic of it all, obviously, it was terrifying. The hospital was kind of figuring out the rules as we were going. The rules changed every day. And our kids were in the NICU for 2 weeks just because they were really small. Thankfully, nothing worse than that. And then as the things with my wife progressed, you know, I'm sure we'll get to it. But like, yes, with all the preamble, I knew what the pre-COVID world was. And I understood the stakes in terms of like climate change, in terms of the direction shit's going domestically as far as politics goes. And I was never was like, well, I can't bring kids into this. And I understand that. And then suddenly I was kind of thinking that and it was way too late, you know?
Right. Yeah. You can't undo that.
No.
It's an interesting situation. And I feel kind of like an asshole for thinking like this sometimes. I don't have kids. And part of the reason that I don't have kids is because this world is in a really precarious place. You know, you talked about climate change. You talked about politics. Is this a world? I mean, first of all, like, look at me. I'm going to be bringing brown children into this world. So there'd be that. What if I bring queer children into this world or children that are trans or non-binary or whatever? Like, there's just a million things that you can't control that you are now responsible for in another human being. So that is like a scare me off kind of thing. And I'm actually curious, and this comes from a really innocent place. Why, with all that, would someone have, you specifically, I guess, have kids?
Yeah, you know, I don't know that there's an answer that's not either selfish or completely delusional. I was thinking about it, And I catch myself having these thoughts too, especially early on when they're really small and I'm just kind of holding them. And sometimes I would just say what I was thinking to them, kind of also apologizing for the state of the world they were thrust into. And having those thoughts like, you know, things are bad, but maybe you guys will get it right. And then it's almost like there's the dads, the cliche of the dads who want their kids to be the football stars they weren't. And mine's like the Comic-Con nerd version where it's like, you're going to be our John Connor. You're going to save humanity. It's such an insane thing to put on a kid, or just to offload that responsibility. Like, well, my hands are tied. It's your problem right now, which is what's kind of happened to us.
Right.
So I don't have a good answer for you, and I don't know that my wife would either. It was something that we both wanted, and we understood the state of the world, and we did it anyway. And who knows? I don't have an answer.
And that's totally fair. A lot of us don't have answers about lots of things. Yeah. So that is just kind of the way humanity is. So you have these kids. It's April 2020. The world is crazy. You have two little boys. When did the depression start to manifest itself?
Yeah. So it was a week after the boys were born. My wife had some complications with a condition called preeclampsia leading up to delivery. The most obvious side effect was she had a lot of like noticeable concerning swelling in her body. Her body was just retaining a lot of water. Mm. There are other factors that they were monitoring it, but the idea was that once the boys were there, things would kind of like stabilize. Hopefully they were born. We were discharged a couple days later. My wife and I came home. Things were not getting better. So we went back to the hospital, which is probably the best thing that could have happened, because while she was there, she slowly started to become paranoid and then gradually like detached from reality. She ended up having a psychotic episode. So like what she had was postpartum psychosis, which the baby books I read mentioned barely. But you know, that word psychosis kind of sticks in your memory. Yeah. So it started slow, or she was just really irritated and paranoid, and we're going on no sleep. So that part of the back of my head that knows this person intimately is like, something's weird. Something's not right here. But obviously we're both exhausted. Everything she's gone through physically on top of the last 9 months. But I mentioned it to a couple of people, to a nurse, to the social worker who was there. And then within 24 hours of her being there, I mean, it was like a full-blown psychotic episode. Screaming, raving, hallucinations. Yeah, it was bad. And so she was brought from the obstetrics hospital where our boys were born to another hospital down the street. They just wanted to put her in like a hospital for adults, not one for babies and pregnant women, to check, make sure there's nothing physically wrong. And she kind of stabilized. And then about a month out, it started to sort of reemerge as something more akin to postpartum depression, but it was bad. She was convinced that there was something wrong with our sons, that it was her fault. Again, like these delusions. Like we were not observing the same truth, you know? And there was nothing that me or anyone, even doctors, could tell her. Like, your kids are fine. You're going through a hard time. We need to help you through this. And yeah, eventually what happened was she confessed to being suicidal and ended up over 2 stays in a psychiatric facility. So that summer, she spent almost 40 days away from us. And again, because of COVID, I dropped her off that first time and I couldn't go in. And the second time, an ambulance took her. So there's that 40-day block where I talked to her on the phone when she wanted to talk. Right. I have no sense of what her world was like for those 40 days because I never got a chance to go in. But yeah, that's the abridged version of what ended up happening. But
I'm just trying to ask questions sensitively and carefully here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Was there any experience with depression or psychosis in either of you prior to this moment?
No, we both had been talking to therapists for some anxiety and some, especially by comparison, mild depression.
Sure.
The history on her side, her brother had been diagnosed bipolar. And unfortunately, he, from something unrelated, died before she and I started dating. So I know that that was like top of mind for her family. And of course I knew enough to be like, you know, again, is this what's going on? Is she bipolar? And we're just only finding out in the worst way possible.
Right.
But it wasn't that. But no, there was no history for it. It was just an unfortunate fluke, I guess, on top of everything else going on. Like that was like the triple whammy, the COVID, the whether or not my job was gone, and then psychosis. It's not the worst case scenario I had imagined, you know, and I have a habit of catastrophizing, and it certainly considered the ways that it could have gone wrong. And this was not it.
Right.
Yeah.
So, okay. You're experiencing this situation with your job where you're not really sure where that's going. We're in the middle of a global pandemic. There's no vaccine. Nobody knows what's going on. People are dying. You've just had two children, mm-hmm. and your spouse is now going through psychosis. What the hell is going through your head?
I mean, everything. I suddenly had two infants to be responsible for. I had an adult in the middle of an emergent mental health crisis. With, at best, help on the other end of a phone. You know, family and friends could help in a limited capacity. I mean, it was isolating. I felt wildly unprepared, and yet I did I somehow compartmentalized the stress in a way that I had to keep those babies alive and cared for. And I knew enough to know that what was happening to my wife was not something we were equipped to handle. And I wonder if that would have been the case if we didn't have twins. Mm. That kind of tipped the scale into my plate is way the fuck too full. I don't know, would I have tried to be a hero if I just had the one kid and thought I could get through every night and take care of whatever was happening with my wife? So yeah, we got my mom kind of moved in for 9 weeks. The hospital had to sign off on her initially because, like I said, my kids were in the NICU for 2 weeks and visitors weren't allowed. But they were like, oh, we haven't seen your wife in a while and we're not judging. We're aware that there are problems, but we got to get you help. So they let my mom come in. And, I was terrified. And it was a kind of fear that I don't know. I had never been so close to something so frightening.
Sure.
Never mind that it was supposed to be the time that a lifetime of media and whatever had sort of conditioned you to be like, these are the happiest days of your life.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So there are these moments where I felt like the biggest piece of shit in the world for feeling love and joy because I'd be dealing with my kid. And then I'd put him down and walk out of the room and my wife's just on the couch with just this dead look. And looking at like through the walls at nothing and just not there. And yeah, it was just a constant tug of war between feeling the best and worst I've ever felt and just being completely helpless. And by the time she went to the psychiatric facility the second time, I just kind of talked myself into accepting hopelessness. And I was like, there's nothing you can do. Don't know how long she's going to be gone. And it sounds so grim and I don't mean this to be insensitive, but it's like you have to think like you're a single dad now.
I understand.
Because there are decisions that had to be made. And she was not able to be the person that I knew she wanted to be in this, you know, adventure we took on together. She was sidelined. And I had to press forward for them and do my best to keep all the other plates spinning. But again, it was all over the phone. I never met her doctors. So I had to trust people who were smart enough to know what they were doing in ways that half of the country seemed to be like deliberately fighting that. We're not going to listen to people who know better right now because I know me better. And I don't know. I couldn't imagine being, you know, in that world and then faced with something like this. I mean, that's all mixed in with all of it, you know? It was this weird thing where when we go in to have the boys, and I managed to get off of Twitter for a couple of days because I'm a little busy. And the first headline I see when I finally have a breather to pull up my phone is Trump suggesting we inject ourselves with bleach. And I was like, I can't. I got to put it
back.
Sorry, guys.
I would have flushed my phone straight down the toilet at that point.
Yeah. Seriously.
Yeah. Wow. Is there any conceivable way in which you could be a supportive partner during a situation like that? I mean, I suffer from depression. I suffer from anxiety. I, you know, have partners who suffer from depression and anxiety. I have experienced it in, you know, people in my friend groups. But when you are in the situation you were in, where things are going like way haywire, what even can you do to be a supportive partner to your spouse?
Yeah, I mean, initially in that first episode she had, there wasn't really much I could do. You know, I did what I could to try to comfort her. And I mean, through pure luck, I managed to sort of stumble on something that clicked and she kind of started settling down. And between that and whatever medication they gave her, she kind of like came down a bit. Once we were home, and like I said, we had a few good weeks, and then it manifested more as what you'd think of as postpartum depression. I certainly did a lot of the wrong things. I tried to do everything thinking it was helpful. And then she was doing like a day program. So there were a couple counseling sessions. And through that, I tried to step back and sort of, because they're saying, you know, you got to let her figure out how she fits in all this. And you know, I tried to give her the space to do that. What was happening was, and again, it's not her fault. It was the sickness. What was happening was I was trying to give her the space, and then she just wasn't doing it. She just wasn't doing stuff. And that's when she's like, oh, well, there's something wrong with them. I'd be like, you know, they're crying. Why don't you try picking them up and comforting them? And she's like, well, we won't do anything. They're broken and it's my fault. So that's not going to help. Yeah, I tried and failed a lot of things. I don't know what I could have done different, because the reality of her condition didn't really leave a lot of room to sort of allow her to find that footing. In our experience, and I don't want to speak for anyone else whose partner goes through something like this, she did not seem to have the capacity to do what some of the healthcare providers were advocating. But I think that has more to do with the severity of what she was experiencing. I think had it been something more mild, it could have gone a different way, but it didn't. And right. It was just something that we came back around to once she was better and home, once our kids got to new milestones. It's like, all right, you take point on this one. And once she was home and safe and like we were getting into the next phases of where the boys were at, that was when that stuff worked. Where I had all my systems, I had what I needed to keep them safe and to keep me going while she was getting inpatient treatment. But then once she was home and those systems didn't have their place anymore, then she started to be more of the author of the things going forward. And then slowly, like by the holidays, the biggest thing in our minds was the fact that our kids were teething and not sleeping. And suddenly it was like, oh, it took 7 months, but we feel like this is what it was supposed to be the whole time, or what we thought we were going to get ourselves into.
Right. So in the middle of all this, who's showing up for you? Like, I obviously, and rightfully, there were lots of people, whether it was you or medical professionals, that were showing up for your wife, but who's showing up for Tony during this time?
Yeah. My mom came down. And she knew she was getting into a pretty heavy situation. And she showed up. She stayed for 9 weeks. She didn't leave until she felt like we were good. My wife Sandra's mom and dad came by and helped when they could. And then we had three really good friends, these three women who would rotate through and help my mom and I get through the overnights, because we were feeding two babies every 3 hours, 24 hours a day. Right. So, you know, they would come some nights. My mom would skip a couple of those late feedings. Sometimes I would skip a couple. Sometimes one of them would show up and my mom had already coordinated and they're like, you're off the clock. We don't want to see you till morning. Just like go get a solid night's sleep. So, yeah, I mean, the village they talk about was you know, barely a household's equivalent of people. It wasn't much of a village, but between my mom, my mother-in-law, and those three friends of ours, I think they saved all of our lives.
Right, I bet.
Yeah.
And it's not about quantity necessarily,
more than
it is about quality.
Right. No. Yeah, it's just like, you know, there are some people like Sandra's work friends who are like, what can we do to help? And I'm like, just stay the fuck away from my house. Because that was the other thing too, is just being so frightened of what people might bring with them, whether they knew it or not.
Right.
You know, Sandra's condition became the sort of primary focus, but COVID was certainly boiling in the background. And I mean, it's not like we were beating people away, but I had to be very prescriptive in the help that I accepted just by virtue of the fact that, I mean, any one of us could have been patient zero.
Nobody knew. Again, it's kind of hard to wrap your head around 4 years later, but there was no vaccine. There was no home testing. Nobody knew what was going on. Nobody knew whether they had it or not. It was such a scary time because you didn't know if an interaction with somebody was going to kill you.
Yeah. Yeah. You'd drive up to a testing facility that looked like something out of Children of Men, and someone jams a Q-tip up into your brain. They were like scraping real deep. Yeah. And it's like, well, this is just how we live for the rest of our life. Like,
insane. Insane to think about. Yeah. So you said that by the time the holidays rolled around, things were back to not normal. I mean, as normal as you can get with two little babies floating around. But things had sort of reached a point of relative normalcy.
Yeah.
And I assume that that was due to a combination of meds and therapy and working through stuff and so on.
Yeah. So meds did not work at first. So she, like I said, she had two stays. The first time she was in for roughly 2 weeks. And I preface this by saying that she's not a very good actor or liar and never has been, but she talked herself home, you know?
Wow.
She said everything that they needed to hear. And I never met any of her care providers, and I'm not disparaging any of them, because I can't imagine, especially working at a place like a psychiatric facility under those conditions, where suddenly people's families and emotional support outside of the healthcare realm are just eliminated.
Yep.
She came home. She was clearly not better. She was clearly only getting worse. You know, meds take a while to see if they're going to be effective. So there's another couple of weeks of just playing kind of roulette with a different cocktail of medications. And then finally, they're like, we got to think about ECT, which is
electroconvulsive
therapy. Yeah. I mean, she called me one day and before I even had hello out of my mouth, she's like, they're going to give me shock treatment. And I was like, well, they mentioned that as a last resort. I'll talk to somebody. And they were like, yeah, this is on the table now. And that's what did it. Unfortunately, a serious side effect of it is that she's really got no memory of the first 6 months. So from shortly before having the boys until around October, that whole 6 months is just like gone. She's got vague impressions. She can remember these little flashes, but she got 3 rounds of ECT for several weeks, came home. And when she came home, she was herself. She had been through it. Physically just seemed like she'd been through the ordeal. She had been, but she was back. She was in love with our kids, which had not been the case. You know, was convinced that, oh, I don't love these things. I shouldn't be a mom. And then she went really hard and she's like, I'm having those dark thoughts again. But she told me, I didn't have to beg it out of her. And then she's like, I'm going to call my therapist and make a plan. And she hadn't been making any plans. When it was bad, she was just like, this is me now. This is where I'm at. And it, like I said, begging her to tell us what she was thinking, begging her to talk to her doctors. So yeah, she made that outreach herself. And then for the next year, she had ECT at regular intervals, initially like once a week. Then they slowly spaced out. The last one was 3 months apart. And then that was September 2021. And they're like, yeah, you don't need this anymore. She's still on medication now, like the ECT, you know, whatever dam was kind of keeping her in and keeping the psychosis out in the forefront, kind of punched through. And then from there, meds kind of did what they were supposed to do. Yeah. So, you know, I would drive her to get those ECT sessions after she came home, pick her up, have to remind her what their names were, remind her what the routines were. So a 20-minute drive, and I had to give her a crash course in being a mom. It was upsetting, and then it became normal, which is the part that kind of wigs me out now, like, sure, just to have lived like that and accepted it. Yeah.
As time goes by, how do you kind of look back at all of this and does that experience, has it colored every interaction that you've had, every experience that you've had in the 3 years, 4 years since the initial outset of it?
Yeah, I mean, it defined my life as a father. And for a long time, I was operating in fight or flight mode, even though I didn't need to. I mean, trust was really hard because when she was deep in the psychosis, when she wasn't talking about wanting to end her life, she would say things like, oh, you'd all be better off without me, so I'm just going to leave. I'm just going to leave and never come back. So when she came home and was like, oh, you need a carton of milk, I'm just going to go to the grocery store to get it. The idea of her getting into a car and driving away from me was terrifying. And it was for a very long time. I became very overly sensitive to when I thought she was maybe overwhelmed. And eventually I realized, oh, what's happening is you're not trusting your wife. And neither of us had ever had these trust issues before. And I had to sort of find an off ramp, you know, because we were through it. And I didn't trust the psychosis. And the psychosis was under control. And like, I'm not saying I stopped being vigilant one day, but, you know, kind of like you were asking how I helped her. Those were moments where I realized, oh, we're butting heads because she's figuring it out and I'm too scared to accept a mistake or a stumble or a hard day as just those things. For me, I was always flashing back to like, this is how it started. The irritability, the paranoia, the whatever. I could go back to that place immediately. And until very recently, I woke up afraid every day that it was going to be the day that it all came back. And then as a result of the experience, I sort of found my way to Postpartum Support International, which does amazing work for women and families. And they had a peer support group for dads. They had one a month. And I was like, this is great, but I think there needs to be more here. So I reached out and I've been volunteering with them for a couple of years now, just facilitating a call once a month, helping them revitalize a Facebook group, a private group for dads to connect. Because I don't know, I can't speak for other dads, but when I was in it, like the last thing I wanted to do, and this sounds really dumb, was research it. Because there was too much going on and I didn't feel like I had the time to stop. But especially with the psychosis, I knew that I would just go down a rabbit hole of reading about all the worst ways it could end for us.
Right. I imagine it being something like when someone has a headache and they go to WebMD and they're like, what's with this headache? They're like, you have cancer, you're going to die.
Yeah. I mean, not far from here in Massachusetts, there's a really high profile case of a woman who likely had postpartum psychosis, and it was awful. And we don't need to get into the details. But we're very lucky, my family and I, and I don't take that for granted. And part of helping with those support groups, just to like give dads that space to sort of to feel less isolated, because, you know, I didn't have any guy friends who had gone through some, and never mind the specifics of what my family went through, but I didn't have another dad I could talk to. So these support groups are really wonderful. Even at this point, being through it, I still get a lot from hearing just other guys talk about what they're struggling with. And it seems like such a oxymoron, I guess, to maybe that's not the right word, but that they're so open with strangers and they feel like they can't do this with the guys in their life, or they just don't have the guys who are willing to listen.
Maybe more of a conundrum than
a conundrum. Yeah. Right. But, you know, I guess it's heartening on the one hand just to see this, a generation of men willing to sort of bear themselves and their fears and their hopes too, with just a bunch of other dudes they've never met on a Zoom call because they know that they're going through something similar. And it's a hard thing. And then the psychosis in particular, you know, I've read a couple of memoirs by women who survived it, but the only time you really hear about it is when something awful happens.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
So.
Yeah, I would imagine a support system is super, super needed for everybody involved in the situation. I mean, maybe except the kids because they're too young to understand what's going on, but certainly both parents involved in that situation need to have the village or some sort of village, like the village you mentioned, to rally around them and talk through this stuff with, because this is such a unique situation. And also, I don't know that parenting in general, under the best of circumstances, is something that is successful in a vacuum. I think, A, kids benefit from having a multitude of perspectives around them, but also parents, adults benefit from having a multitude of perspectives around them, particularly with something like parenting, where I was going to say, like, there's no manual for it. There are plenty of manuals for it, but each instance is so unique.
Right. Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean, the baby books are just a rough sketch of, you know, condensing thousands of years of human experience to the broadest of strokes.
Right.
For me, it was helpful just to have a repository of information to be like, okay, we're in this chapter now. But then you got to figure out the specifics of your kid. And like, you know, with twins, I can guarantee that no two kids are the same. I had two very different experiments happening right before my eyes the whole time. And you're constantly comparing them, which isn't fair to either of them or fair to you, because you kind of take for granted that they're still human beings, even if they're not doing much.
Right.
You're like, how can they be that different? But they are. And that was a struggle. And I didn't have my partner with me when one kid was just housing a bottle in 10 minutes and the other one was taking an hour and a half to finish half as much, only to throw it up all over the place.
Right.
I didn't have someone there to troubleshoot. My mom was around, those friends were around, and I could bounce ideas off them, but they weren't their moms. And they told me, like, we have no place to tell you what to do. We can advise you and we can support you, but they're your kids and you're the ones making the decisions. You have to do what you think is right.
Right.
And it didn't always feel right. But yeah, we got through it.
Well, now you got walking, talking kids.
Yeah, sure do.
You know, it's weird to think that 2020 was 4 years ago, but by the time this episode is live, your kids will be 4 years old.
Yeah.
And what does that feel like now that you have two humans with personalities that can talk to you and not reason with you yet, but you've got two little humans?
It's wonderful and it's hard, man. Like, three was very tough. And, you know, like, terrible twos. Two has really good PR, but was not that bad. And three sucked. Three was really hard because they're these amazing little brains really came online. And they're so funny, too. I mean, there are moments where it's like living with a couple of like real potheads, because like we're having dinner and my son Max one day just dropped his fork and was like, I can't see my face. And it's like, yeah, nobody can see their own face, man. But they see these bizarre things and they connect the weirdest dots, and watching them activate, like I said, it's such a marvel. And then at the same time, man, they're so stubborn. And, you know, twins were difficult in that the volume of work was a lot, but three was when it felt hard. And when I started to struggle with stuff that I know I inherited from my dad, and through no fault of his own, because it was the way it was modeled to him as well. But, you know, anger has been a problem and trying to manage that. And it's getting better, but it had to get called out a lot. And it hurts when they notice, and before you open your mouth, they catch that thing in your eye and they're like, don't get mad, you know, you're going to be mean. And I have been, and it doesn't feel good, but we're working on it. And when they were infants and when Sandra was in the hospital, I leaned on systems that I needed, I think, more than anything to keep myself focused and on top of everything. And we outgrew those systems, and I hung on to them too long. And the same thing's happening now. And now Sandra and I are both doing it, where we're clinging to routines that don't work for them anymore. And you can't reason with them, but there is a negotiation that has to happen in picking your battles and what's important. And do you want them to grow up thinking you're the mean guy for something completely stupid that you're not even going to remember in, you know, a day what you were mad about? And that's the thing, too. It just comes so fast and it's gone. Because I'm not an angry person, but it just comes up in weird ways. And they don't need to grow up being afraid that I'm going to lash out at them for something trivial. It's so shitty. And I remember that feeling. And for what it's worth, you know, I'm trying.
I think that counts for something. I mean, look, yeah. I'm not in your life, but I think that recognizing where habits come from and yeah. recognizing how you react in certain situations and acknowledging it and then working to change it, however slow the change comes, I think is important.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I mean, yeah. I would imagine that as a parent, you are thinking about your own childhood and things that were right about it, things that were wrong about it, and trying to replicate the things that went correctly and not replicate the things that did not go yeah. correctly. What is something that you think maybe didn't go the best in your childhood that you are going to try really hard to not replicate with your boys?
I really want... I want to foster in them a curiosity that it took me way too long to sort of discover on my own. And I think the way to do that is to be better at faking an interest in their stuff. You know, it took a long time for my dad and I to sort of figure out how to talk to each other, even where interests overlapped. If we were interested in the same thing, we were interested in different aspects of it, and we didn't know how to talk to each other. Or neither of us could fake an interest in something that we didn't give a shit about.
Right.
So, you know, for me, that's like, because it doesn't matter. If my kids turn out to be like, yeah, we're lacrosse kids, I'm going to love lacrosse. Because if they love it, I want them to love something fully and not be ashamed of anything. Or not be like, oh, I want to do it, but it's not for me because other people make it feel like it's not for me. I liked art and being on stage and doing stuff like that. But, you know, I grew up at a time when that was very much like, oh, no, that's girl stuff or that's gay. And that never bothered, like, who gives a shit? But I was so, I liked myself so little that I was like, well, I got to fight for the scraps to have these assholes think I'm interesting. So, you know, I don't want my kids to grow up ashamed of what is in their hearts or in their heads, you know, and I got two white boys. Historically, things are kind of stacked in their favor. And it's my job to make sure that they don't grow up to be assholes or just entitled pieces of shit. And I don't fear that my kids are going to do that, but the examples of that are everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And there's too much of it. And, you know, it feels so stupid to be like, oh, the responsibility of raising white men. But there is a responsibility because there's a very wrong way to be a white man. And there's this cycle that has to stop. And like, and that, I mean, that's my priority as they get older is recognizing what privilege means and the right ways to use that privilege to speak out and use that voice for good, or at the very least, just not to be a dick to people for no reason. You know, I grew up in a very small town and there's only white people, and the things I heard kids my age saying, you'd go over to their house and you'd be like, oh, they heard from dad.
Yeah, of course.
Because there's no frame of reference for that. You realize in hindsight, I mean, I didn't think about this too deeply when I was 12, but I remember what I heard. I remember what was done. And it's in our backyards. And now the mask is kind of coming off, and yeah, it's a lot easier to find out which families are the ones you got to worry about exposing your children to. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, and they're not hiding behind much anymore. They've been kind of given free rein to exist. I mean, look, it's hard raising children no matter what. And I say that as not a parent. I know it was hard raising me. I see my friends who are parents deal with this stuff. It is not an easy job, and I commend anybody who makes an effort to raise their child or children the right way. But there's so much out there. I mean, you got to be careful about who your children are interacting with for a variety of reasons. You got to worry about what they're learning from their peers. And, you know, something I didn't have when I was a kid that is everywhere now is technology.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't have a cell phone until I was like 24. So it is. Right.
Yeah, I mean, what's going to happen? I'm gonna be, like, they're going to be watching some unboxing video, and then 6 months in, you're going to find out the guy's like a Nazi or something. It's weird. Yeah, the direct feed to our children's brains is completely out of our control. I mean, it is and it isn't. I think, you know, if I were a few years younger, I probably would have gone into more shenanigans on the internet than my parents were equipped to intercept, just because they weren't especially interested or curious in that technology.
But nobody knew it was going to become as pervasive as it's become.
Right. Right. Or certainly it was still very much a novelty, and yeah, no one was thinking about what the dark corners of this thing might have even looked like back then. So, I mean, at least technology is just ingrained enough in our lives now that, you know, barring something radical emerging between now and when my kids are like 10 or whatever, who knows, maybe we'll be able to sort of keep an eye on what's on their radar, but who knows? I mean, it only takes one, you know, whatever the next iPhone, whatever the yeah, next seismic shift is going to be, and then suddenly we don't talk that language. I mean, TikTok right, terrifies me, but
you know? As it should. as it should. So outside of parenting, well, first of all, back to parenting, even though we haven't really left it yet, like, are you, with this experience that you've had and that you're still having, and the support group is great. I think it's really important for A, there to be men's support groups as a general rule, and mm-hmm, B, for people to kind of take leadership roles in men's groups that are not like the archetype of take off your shirt and dance around a fire and hate women.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But things that foster communication and belonging and all of those good buzzwords. But are you going to do anything else with this story? Like, I mean, you have written about it. I think that's how I found you.
Yeah. Yeah. I wrote a piece for a local publication here, for Rhode Island Monthly, that was kind of like the whirlwind version of events, starting obviously when we had the boys, and then the vaccines sort of rolled out as I was writing it, and we were able to get our first shots. So it was a nice bookend to feeling like we were kind of emerging out of a couple of, one very personal and one more communal crisis. And I wrote a piece for Insider last year as well. But yeah, not to get too far ahead of myself here, but I have been working on a manuscript for the last year with the intent of polishing and trying to shop around a memoir of sorts about it. Still very early days there. But yeah, I'm always thinking about how I can sort of use the experience, not use it, but speak to it, because yes, like I said, it's so isolating because it is not talked about enough. And I think just to let people feel seen and heard, and to be able to recognize your own nightmare in somebody else, because I never found that when we were in it. I didn't, like I said, I didn't look very hard because I was afraid of what I might find. But there is a, I almost said a comfort, and that's not the right word. One thing that comes up a lot in these groups is that there is a solidarity, and there is something to knowing that you're not witnessing these things or experiencing them yourselves, because dads can experience postpartum depression or perinatal mood disorders as well.
Tony, you froze.
Oh, it takes you out of the isolation. I think the isolation is one of the worst parts about, obviously not the worst part, but like, you just feel trapped. You feel like you're living through something for the first time, because you might be, but someone else has gone through it. And I think just having that conversation, or just that nod, that acknowledgement. So that's what I'm hoping. And part of it too is, like I said, my wife doesn't remember, and she sort of gave me the green light early on. She's like, this is what you do. So tell our story, get it out of your head for yourself, preserving parts of it for her. But then if people can recognize something and feel, like I said, seen, find some sort of help in that, that's what I'm trying to do with our experience now that we're through it. So
what are you doing to take care of yourself? Not only based on the experience that you that your wife had, mm-hmm, that you were a part of, but also just as a dad of 2 4-year-olds that is probably stressed the fuck out. Mm-hmm. Like, to use an overused term, what are you doing for self-care? What are you doing to look out for yourself and make sure that you're okay?
Yeah, you know, my days do not belong to me anymore. So from when they wake up to when they go to bed, if I'm not at work, I'm doing their stuff. So I'm finding times in those off hours. I started getting up earlier than I ever thought I would, even with kids, to like just carve out time to start my day for me. And once I go to bed, I, you know, my wife and I will do game night, which is super dorky, but like, just, and we're putting our,
I love a game night, Tony. It's not dorky at all.
No, but like putting our phones down and just having to hunch over a board and like, and casually just like having conversations again. It's so nice to not be talking about what the kids need all the time, the household stuff. I'm finding stuff. It's getting warmer. I'll ride my bike again. That's good. Blow off some steam. Just solve all the world's problems in 20 miles and come back. Yeah. My writing is an outlet, but a lot of it's focused on what we went through. And I'm gentle with myself. When it feels hard, I'd put it down. And I think if I had really held my feet to the fire early on, I wouldn't have got as far with this thing as I have so far. I would have bailed on it because it was a tough thing to relitigate, even being removed from it. But yeah, I'm in no rush to do anything. You know, I think that's a thing too, is life was all chaos and life or death for the months that we were struggling with our shit. And then until the world kind of stumbled back into being relatively normal-ish. I mean, the idea that the old world is ever going to come back.
It's ridiculous.
It's gone. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm ready. I kind of made, you know, I'm not a resolutions guy, but this is the year that I'm going to stop being so afraid of the world. Some exposure therapy, I think, is going to help a bit. I, you know, finally went to a concert for the first time since pre-COVID.
Wow. Nice. No, I got congratulations. COVID. Oh, did you really? Jeez. Yeah. Yeah. That did not end the way that I was hoping it would end.
You know what? It's all right. It was fine. I did it. I'll get to another one. But yeah, more than even the psychosis stuff, the COVID stuff, on top of being a dad, kind of lost myself for a little bit. And trying to, you know, just get back to it. Just get back to some confidence, some social stuff that I have gotten very rusty at, which was never easy, but I had made a lot of progress before the world shut down. But yeah, getting there, baby steps.
There you go. So.
Thank you, Tony, for being so forthcoming and so honest about your story and what you and your family have gone through these last couple of years. Certainly wish you the best. You're welcome back on the show anytime, of course. For those of you who want to know more about Tony, you can follow him online. His Instagram is Tony_Pacitti. TONY_PACITTI. In his bio, you can also find a link to the article that speaks about his family story a bit more. I don't want to say more in depth. It's a story you read as opposed to a story you listen to. And, you know, the differences that those two things have are, you know, what you'll find in the online article versus this podcast. Anyway. Thanks again, Tony. Thank you, as always, for listening, and I will catch you soon. Thank you for listening to Detoxicity. I hope you found this particular episode interesting, and if you are new, I hope you go back and listen to all of the older episodes. Once again, my name is Mike Joseph. I am the host and producer of this show, and there are a lot of things that you can do to continue to support our mission, continue to support this podcast. Follow me on social media. I am on Instagram, Twitter, and I'm on TikTok as Detox Pod Guy. You can also send me an email if you'd like. I'm at detoxpod@gmail.com. I am always on the hunt for people with interesting, inspirational, and powerful stories. So if you know somebody who fits that bill, or if you yourself fit that bill, please don't hesitate to drop me a line via email or via social media. Please make sure you subscribe on your podcast platform that you're listening to this on. Rate, comment, help a brother out, help us move up in the rankings, follow me on social media, like I said, follow our Patreon, or subscribe to my Patreon, actually, patreon.com/detoxicitypod. You get access to exclusive episodes, you get episodes a little earlier than the general public, you get a cool-ass sticker, lots of stuff. Once again, patreon.com/detoxicitypod. Quick shout out to Calvin Williams for providing the music and doing his magic on the logo, which was originally designed by Jacob Block. I thank you all for listening. I wish you all the best. Please take care of each other. Till next time, peace.